Thought Leadership from PwC.
It does appear the staff has kind of taken a targeted approach to its reviews of filings, as the comments that they've issued, at least for the 30 or so companies that we understand actually received comment letters, they're limited solely to climate-related issues.
In talking to companies leading up to the disclosures, I think some of the things they struggled with was, you know, how do we determine whether something is material to understanding our business?
Continuing our ESG reporting miniseries with a deeper dive into the SEC's climate and human capital disclosure requirements, this is PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn, and thanks so much for joining us today. I'm going to kick off today with a quote from SEC Chair Gary Gensler's July 28, 2021 speech before PRI. Why am I talking about climate risk? Simple. Because investors are. Today, investors increasingly want to understand the climate risks of the companies whose stock they own or might buy. Investors are looking for consistent, comparable, and decision-useful disclosures so they can put their money in companies that fit their needs. Chair Gensler's speech went on to make the case for why updates to public company disclosures could bring needed transparency to the capital markets and how this goal was consistent with the SEC's mission to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. So, part of our deep dive into the requirements that are shaping ESG reporting around the globe, today we're going to dive a little deeper into what we expect to see coming from the SEC. Joining me today are Kyle Moffitt, a partner in PwC's SEC Services Group, and Sheree Wyatt, a partner in PwC's ESG practice and our diversity leader for Trust Solutions. They'll focus on disclosures relating to both human capital and climate change and where things currently stand with the SEC. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. So Kyle, Sheree, as always, so nice to have you back. And I think in particular, this is a topic that all of our listeners are interested in hearing what's coming next on. But just to kick things off, Kyle, let's level set. And we've been talking about disclosures related to human capital and climate change. Things have changed a little bit from a timing point of view since last time we spoke. So can you give us the latest?
Sure. You know, obviously, we're quickly approaching a year into the new administration. We've seen the SEC's Reg Flex agenda, which, for a reminder for folks, it actually lists all of the rules that the SEC will focus on over the next 12 months. And it is primarily ESG focused. And so with respect to the E, it's the climate change proposing release. With respect to the S, we expect a proposing release on human capital, which I know Sheree is going to talk about. We also expect a proposing release on board diversity, and that might be similar to NASDAQ's comply or explain model. And then with respect to the G, many proxy rulemakings on the agenda, such as universal proxy and proxy advisory firms. And then, of course, another item to keep an eye on is the staff is we expect a proposing release on the cybersecurity risk governance topic. We've also seen that, you know, the largest divisions and offices in the agency focused on ESG issues, primarily climate, the focus of the enforcement division and exam program on all of these topics, including the topic of greenwashing. And in Corp Fin, you know, obviously much anticipated comment letters from Corp Fin staff to registrants on climate change. And I'd say a more recent development is the recent change in the staff's views regarding shareholder proposals.
Yes. And Kyle, being someone who doesn't watch the SEC as closely as you, I have to say that one took at least me a little bit by surprise. So before we jump in to the specifics on some of the developments, you know, climate, human capital is advertised, can you just share what that proposal means and your reaction to it?
So I'll start by saying I'm not a lawyer. However, when I was at the staff, I did pay attention to kind of this space and you know, it was obviously a big undertaking by the staff and Corp Fin to deal with no action requests that would come into the division. Essentially, it was companies would submit an analysis, a legal analysis of the proxy rules, 14A8, which apply to shareholder proposals. And companies, you know, management would typically, you know, view a lot of these proposals and would want to actually exclude those proposals from the proxy statement. In short, this staff recently rescinded the prior staff guidance and replaced it with a new staff legal bulletin that might result, we expect, an increase in the submission of social, political, and environmental shareholder proposals, and might also lead to an increase in the number of those proposals actually being included on proxy statements. So why should companies be paying attention to this? Well, it's going to be more difficult for companies to justify the exclusion of a proposal from its proxy statement. And we might see shareholders, you know, proposals coming in, obviously focused on ESG goals and metrics, reporting in their filings rather than their sustainability reports, and even linking ESG goals or metrics to executive pay. You know, the other item to point out, it's not a new rulemaking, so it wasn't subject to a vote by the commission, but it was interesting. The Republican commissioners published a statement essentially disagreeing with the change.
So then, Kyle, I have to say your last statement took me a little by surprise. So why the disagreement?
You know, I think largely you find the Republican commissioners are, you know, more supportive of, you know, management's, you know, approach and their assessment and analysis of, you know, what proposal you might include, obviously the board as well. And so I think the view has always been leave it to the companies to determine. And then I think their view now is, and I won't get into the details because the statement that they published does get into those details. But, you know, obviously they tend to disagree with anything the Democrats, you know, push for, you know, more prescriptive disclosure requirements. They're not in favor of. They're in favor of the principles-based disclosure requirements. I think they're concerned about materiality. They're concerned about other issues, micromanagement, shareholders being too involved in some of these topics and issues.
All right. Well, that's helpful perspective. And I also appreciate sort of the overall, the overview you gave of this, because I do think the tie into ESG is interesting when you think about, you know, where this could go. So potentially more to come, I guess we'll see as that sort of unfolds in practice. So let's now turn our attention to some of the specifics we're planning to talk about today, and starting with human capital disclosure requirements. And it's interesting because you made the comment about principles-based, which when those disclosure requirements were put out, they were much more principles-based. Why are we seeing this on the regulatory flex agenda again this year?
Well, you know, in their deliberations in the past, when they adopted the initial principles-based rule with Jay Clayton as the chair, the Democrats obviously were in the minority, and they didn't think the commission went far enough. They, again, like you said, it's principles-based rulemaking, but they didn't view it as something that would actually elicit informative disclosures. And Gensler's come on board and agrees with that assessment. And he's been clear about wanting prescriptive disclosure requirements such as workforce diversity. And while we haven't seen much either in the way of staff comments on the topic, but you know, similar to their approach that they're taking on climate, it wouldn't surprise me to see the staff start to focus on quantitative human capital disclosures as they're thinking about this proposed release on human capital.
Well, so Cherie, I mean, one of the things you've been on the podcast before and talked about is the fact that we did sort of see the disclosures were, I don't want to say all over the place, but there was a wide range of disclosures in response to the requirements. And so what are you hearing in terms of the latest?
Yeah, so for lack of a better term, there was a lot of diversity in the disclosures that we saw. In talking to companies leading up to the disclosures, I think some of the things they struggled with was, you know, how do we determine whether something is material to understanding our business? And I think that continues to be a dialogue around how do I assess materiality? Something may be important to me, but it may not necessarily be, you know, financially material. And then companies also, you know, struggled with this concept of, you know, the balance of quantitative versus qualitative. So we saw many companies kind of take a measured approach to this first disclosure, obviously wanting to comply with the kind of principles of the guidance, obviously the required disclosure around the number of employees, and also wanting to, you know, talk a bit about what's been going on in their business from a human capital perspective. So we saw a lot of disclosures around COVID-19, the actions that companies were taking in order to create a safe workforce and deal with some of the challenges from a people perspective. But the areas where we saw probably the most, most diversity was around things like, gender, race, ethnicity disclosures, which is one of the areas where we saw, particularly in 2020, more and more investors wanting more information, wanting more data around what the organization looks like. And so when you think about the principle behind the previous rule was very much focused from a company's perspective on what's material to understanding your business. So a management type approach. Under Gensler's administration is very much focused on investors. What do investors want to know and hear? And that's where we're starting to see more of the commentary around getting prescriptive around things like workforce turnover, workforce demographic, which is where we're seeing a lot of investor interest.
So let me ask a question. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because you mentioned COVID and that was last year, obviously still a factor, but then this year we're also just seeing a lot more in general from a human capital perspective, the great resignation, a lot of unhappiness, I guess, for lack of a better word, with the workforce, labor movements, just it feels like even more activity than a year ago. So even absent new rulemaking, have you started to see or would you expect to see a shift in the types of things people are talking about?
Absolutely. And I think that's why they made it a principle-based standard to be able to be fluid based off of what's going on in the world. And certainly last year, COVID-19 was. But when you think about the risks to a company's business around workforce, definitely the great resignation, definitely employee satisfaction and kind of the employee engagement index, I think are going to be of great interest to many investors. So I would personally expect to see more of that in this upcoming filing.
All right. So potentially more to come. And again, we'll see when we start to talk about the potential new rules. And then another question for you is that I think normally people generally think of E in its own bucket, then S in its own bucket, and then maybe G, there's, link in with both of those, depending on how you look at that. But it's interesting. I saw recently in the Financial Times a stat that said that companies with higher board gender diversity perform stronger on climate action, which again, it's like, okay, I don't directly see that connection. So what do you make of that? And what have you seen in the work you're doing?
Yeah, I would say the kind of underlying kind of concept there is the studies that we've seen around diverse boards being high performing boards. Having more of a strategic focus with different diverse points of view being brought to the table. When you think about ESG as a strategic opportunity for companies, that's where you're seeing, diverse boards, bringing a good perspective to the table, right? So it's not surprising. It is an interesting connection. I definitely would agree with that. But I do think it's kind of foundational in this concept of diversity, right? And so when we see investors that are, asking and requiring for more diverse boards, more diverse workforce, it's not just, the feel good aspect of it and kind of doing the right thing for society. It really is around, these companies tend to perform better at creating long-term value when you're bringing diverse points of view to the table, strategically, as well as from an innovation side.
And then putting aside the fact that it actually could be beneficial to company, there's also, we're seeing more and more requirements, right? So California, stock exchange requirements, et cetera, for diversity. And so do you see that fitting in with the SEC requirements? It's just sort of like a parallel path. There's more requirements and we're going to need more disclosure.
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of both. And we're seeing it in different sectors as well. I mean, the media sector, they've, set forth some specific requirements around, what does the kind of demographics of a film set, kind of look like, right? To make sure we're creating, equitable opportunities. And so I think there's so many different pockets, which create some challenges for companies just in terms of a compliance perspective. Right now they're on parallel paths, but hopefully we'll start to get some convergence and consistency in what the requirements are.
All right. So Sheree, definitely a lot then to your point for companies to think about and to pay attention to. We'll come back to what we think may be changes in requirements, but it sounds like in the meantime, your advice to companies is really think about what's going on in the external environment and impacting your company and make sure that's getting incorporated in your disclosures.
Yeah, and absolutely. And when we start to hear, Kyle talk about some things happening from a climate perspective, I think there are some things you can draw upon that as you start thinking about this upcoming disclosure.
All right. That's helpful. So then, Kyle, let me turn back to you. And in particular, I know a lot of our listeners are tuning in to hear about climate change disclosures because it's been such a hot topic. But before we get into the details, you know, it's been, as you started with, almost a year into the new administration. And can you share with us sort of what's going on at the SEC within the last year, you know, related to climate?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it has been definitely very interesting last few months, I'd say. Obviously, heightened focus on climate change related risk disclosures. You know, I guess kind of going back in time a bit, when Allison Lee was acting chair, she directed the staff in CorpFin to consider updating the 2010 interpretive release. She posted a statement with about 60 questions soliciting feedback on climate change risk disclosures. Of course, we saw, you know, hundreds of unique letters from the public on that request. Fast forward to, you know, they actually announced this creation of the Climate and ESG Task Force that's being led by the Enforcement Division. And, you know, it is comprised of staff across the agency as well. So it has, I would imagine, members from all the various divisions and offices that are touching on this topic, which I would think be most of them right now. You know, and that task force really was focused on, you know, or will be focused on identifying ESG related misconduct, such as greenwashing. For example, if funds or advisors are touting an ESG strategy, the task force is going to analyze those disclosures and compliance issues relating to those strategies, and going to go after companies that are misstating what they're actually doing. They're also focusing on identifying any gaps or misstatements in issuers' disclosure of climate risks under the existing rules. I'd say that has probably led, I mean, it's another piece of this, which is a pretty big piece, which is this focus on issuing comments. So the staff at CorpFin are actually issuing comment letters to companies right now on climate change related risk disclosures.
Well, and I think, Kyle, similar to what I was just talking to Sheree about, you know, even absent new rules, there's a lot for companies to be thinking about in disclosure here. And so, you know, it's a lot of interest in these comments that companies are receiving. And we had, you know, sort of the sample comments that were put out there. But what are you hearing in terms of how, or seeing in terms of how CorpFin is approaching its review?
Well, you know, it took a bit of time, I'd say. I think we expected, when we first started hearing that this was going to be a focus of CorpFin, it took a little bit of time. But, you know, one of the things I've said previously is, you know, the staff has been pretty overwhelmed with their reviews of transactional filings. So the SPAC backlog, the de-SPAC transactions, the IPOs, it is an unprecedented number of transactions they've looked at over the past year. But it does appear the staff has kind of taken a targeted approach to its reviews of filings, as the comments that they've issued, at least for the, you know, 30 or so companies that we understand actually receive comment letters, they're limited solely to climate related issues. Obviously, a coordinated effort. They got the letters all out at the same time, which was pretty interesting. And as you mentioned, that, you know, they have posted this a dear issuer letter of sample comments that are actually being issued to registrants, and it's on the SEC's website.
Yes, and we'll include a link to that in the show notes. But so, you know, you said it's only, you know, 30 or so, you know, three dozen registrants. So do we have any sense for how they determined which registrants to issue comments to?
You know, I'd expect that the staff really, especially when they take on projects like this, like targeted reviews, they're going to focus on companies that you know, either have the largest market caps or even those with a bigger, you know, what they perceive to have a bigger climate footprint, especially in industries where you'd expect to see more robust disclosure. You know, it does appear, though, that you know, the comment letters, at least from the ones I've seen or even heard about, they've touched all, they're spread across all industries. So the staff is not discriminating. They are focused on every single industry. And we're, of course, hearing more. You know, more comments are coming out. And I expect we'll continue to see comments coming out on other registrant reviews in the future. But, you know, I think that staff likes to take the approach of getting comments out there in the public space. Obviously, they posted the Dear Issuer letter, really with the hope that people see that letter and that peers and others, you know, in the industry might follow suit with improved disclosure. And then people know what to expect. They know the staff is focused on it and they're going to be issuing comments.
All right. So Kyle, sort of to your point, the Dear Issuer letter is out there and we will include a link to it. But I know there's also a lot of interest in what was in the actual letters that were issued and you've seen some of those. So anything in particular that you would highlight?
You know, the staff really is focused on where they believe there's a perceived gap between what's disclosed in the CSR report versus what's disclosed in the 10K. I'd say that that's kind of the general or generic, area that they've issued comments on. For example, you know, if you say that something's material in your CSR report, but you don't disclose anything in your 10K, the staff's going to ask. And they've asked pointed questions about that. And the focus is also around compliance with the 2010 interpretive release. It's really anchored to all of the interpretive guidance that the commission provided back in 2010.
All right. And so to that point, we've put out some guidance on what's in there. But can you just remind listeners of some of the key things to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, it really is the approach the staff took in developing that interpretive release was to focus on the existing SEC disclosure requirements and how they apply to the issues such as climate change. You know, and so as a reminder, it highlights several sections of Regulation SK that may be applicable. So you have your description of business. Essentially, you would disclose any material effects that compliance with government regulations, especially environmental regulations, may have on a company's capital expenditures, earnings. Second, you'd have the legal proceeding section, and there it's really disclosures regarding environmental litigation. The third is risk factors, and I think we've mentioned this in the past, that this is typically the area where you see disclosures, and this essentially requires a discussion of those material factors that make an investment in the company risky. And then finally, MD&A, which I'd say is an area we probably haven't seen as much disclosure. And so really, it's in this section, it's being mindful of the risks and opportunities of climate change when identifying, discussing, and analyzing any known material trends and uncertainties.
All right. And Kyle, as I mentioned, we do have a publication that goes into detail. So I'm not going to ask you to list every disclosure, but within those three areas, any particular items that you would highlight as maybe be more prone to comment or that you would advise companies to focus on?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, you know, typically what I like to say when I talk to companies or our clients is really to take a step back and ask questions that are posed in that. And I think it's a very good roadmap for companies to follow. And kind of as a flavor for that, it's really just thinking about, you know, the possible indirect consequences or opportunities that are presented, such as decreased demand for goods that produce significant GHG emissions, increased demand for goods that result in lower emissions than competing products. You know, think about, you know, the possible consequences of severe weather events or rising sea levels, declines in the availability and quality of water, which I think is one area that a lot of people don't think about, and the potential for those to affect the, you know, operations and results. So as an example, you think about, you know, the change in climate and severe weather events. For registrants with operations on coastlines, have they experienced property damage or disruptions to their operations? Are they experiencing higher insurance costs or even insurance claims? You know, obviously, we talked about the disclosure of the impact of new legislation or regulations. And so costs required to improve facilities and equipment to reduce emissions in order to meet certain regulatory mandates. So those are some of the things I think that registrants need to be thinking about. And really, it is taking a step back and looking at that 2010 interpretive release, looking at their disclosures in the CSR report, in their filings and evaluate maybe where they're missing, where there is a gap.
So then, Kyle, I think that's all helpful perspective. One thing in particular that we've talked a little bit about is the fact that, and I think you mentioned this, that the comments have asked specifically about the corporate social responsibility report, you know, if there's, why you have information there and not in your 10K filing or otherwise. And so that definitely caught my interest and just curious your reaction to seeing that in the questions.
Yeah, no, I think that was obviously very interesting. I think everyone had, I imagine, a similar reaction. It's not typically something that you see the staff referencing in their comments is a sustainability report or CSR reports. And, you know, really this, you know, I ran the review program, and obviously worked in the review program for a number of years. And so, you know, really in order to meet the Sarbanes-Oxley mandate, there's no requirement to conduct a detailed review of CSR reports. The staff is required to review the financial statements of a company once every 3 years. And typically it's financial statement is done by an accountant. And so, you know, it's not to say the staff didn't historically look at CSR reports. I've looked at them in the past, and I know that the staff have as well. I can also tell you the staff looks at information beyond a company's filings with the SEC. They look on their websites. They look at investors' presentations and slides. But, you know, interestingly, in this space, it's clear, you know, the administration has made it clear that this is a priority. And, you know, they're going to continue to issue comments in this space. I expect they'll continue to review these reports in their ordinary course of filing reviews and continue to issue comments.
So then, Kyle, I know there's always interest. So that's helpful perspective on this, the CSR reports. I know also our listeners would like to know how the companies that receive these letters are responding. Do we have any sense of that yet?
So I don't want to give too much away with respect to responses that aren't public yet. So I'll just be very generic and broad in kind of how I explain or at least how I think companies and of course, outside counsel is probably helping a lot with this. I'd imagine most are replying and stating they don't believe it's material for disclosure in an SEC filing. In other words, I'd expect most will focus on materiality in the Supreme Court's definition versus kind of the reason or purpose for their CSR reports and reporting. You know, I'd say some registrants I've seen have provided quantification of costs in response to support their argument that it's not quantitatively material. But the interesting point here to make is that the SEC has already been issuing a number of follow-up comments to the first round of comments.
All right. And so I want to come back to materiality, but let's finish off on the comment mm-hmm. letters. So what types of follow-up questions are we already seeing?
So it's very interesting. I'd say that you know, it's not typical how the staff typically handles when a company responds and indicates something's not material. The staff usually doesn't dig in and ask for proof that it's not material. I'd say that, you know, obviously most registrants have responded to the first round of comments. You know, the interesting kind of data point is that some of these follow-up comment letters actually have more comments in them than the first round of comments. So they're really digging in a bit, peeling it back a bit, and they're asking more pointed questions, really focused on, you know, companies' conclusions as to how they determined, how they assessed materiality in determining that the impact of some of these disclosures is not material, really looking for further explanation of how materiality was analyzed, further detail on how they assess materiality and concluding that indirect impacts, compliance costs, and that sort of thing are not material. They're even asking for more detail regarding some of the projects, capital expenditures, costs that the companies would be incurring in the future to achieve certain goals. You know, of course, peeling back a bit on net zero commitments. You know, what are the costs of achieving those commitments and provide disclosure of those costs? And if not, why not? They're also asking for more support and quantification of the impacts of weather-related damages. So they are really, really digging in, you know, and I don't expect, you know, this is going to be as quick of a turnaround time or closure of the filing review as people typically see. I think they're going to keep issuing comments until they're completely satisfied. I guess the other area is just the judgments involved. And so they're really asking for a lot about how companies are you know, thinking about providing disclosure on a registrant's assessment of litigation risk, which as you know, you think about a contingency, mm-hmm. is quite challenging. And so that's an area where I think I've heard some clients are really struggling to figure out how to explain away some of the comments that staff has actually issued.
Wow. So it sounds like definitely more to come. And I guess to that point, companies that haven't received comments yet, I think would be interested to know when some of this information will be made public. I know there's a delay though. So what are you thinking from a time frame point of view, particularly if it's going to take longer to resolve than maybe we originally anticipated?
You know, usually I tell folks about a month. So it's the policy that the staff has is 20 business days after the review is complete, the SEC will post its correspondence. And so those comment letters and responses, I think initially I thought they might start coming out November, December timeframe. But based on the last round of comments that I've seen, I think companies are going to have to spend some time figuring out how to quantify and how to respond in an adequate way in order to kind of more hopefully not have more rounds of comments from the staff. You know, it largely depends on the number of rounds that you have, but I think we'll start to see December timeframe some trickle out, and then obviously over the next couple months after that.
All right. This sounds like more to come. So then let me go back to something you were talking about, which is just that a lot of this seems to center around materiality. And obviously, you know, each company has to think of its own circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But with all those caveats in place, how in general, what it would be a framework for thinking about materiality in this context?
Well, you know, I won't answer that question directly.
Exactly.
Right. You know, it is a concept that is very difficult to address. You know, it's a legal concept, and that's why we refer to the case law. You know, materiality is defined based on the Supreme Court's definition of what is material. And so there is relevant case law, a number of cases. There are specific rules, the 33 Act and also the 34 Act, which are almost identical, but they have provided definition of material. And then you just look at, you know, the case, you know, Basic versus Levinson, followed by other Supreme Court cases, some as recently as the 2000s. And essentially, it's, you know, information is material if it is substantially likely that a reasonable investor would have viewed this information as having significantly altered the total mix of information made available. That's a mouthful. And the challenge with it is really in applying the definition, you know, how do you define substantially likely? You know, and who is a reasonable investor? You know, what's the total mix of information made available? And so there's a lot to unpack there. And I don't think it's clear how the SEC is going to apply this concept of materiality to the reporting of the impact of climate change or even other ESG topics, such as human capital, in these upcoming proposing releases. So, you know, really until we see a proposing release and eventually an adopting release, companies really need to be mindful about including statements that these ESG topics or issues such as climate are material to management or the company in their CSR reporting, or even their public statements or commitments. In other words, you know, if the SEC staff hears you saying that, they may ask you to disclose, you know, anything that you label as material in your SEC filings. When I think about materiality and the context of the securities laws, I think about it from the perspective of an investor. Reporting on ESG topics, I think it goes beyond the investor. I mean, Cherie would tell you that. I mean, it's there for all stakeholders to consider and evaluate.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just hit the key question of this debate, right? In terms of who is this information for, the purpose of the rulemaking, et cetera. But it sounds like in the near term, as companies are responding, they just need to make sure there's consistency in their messaging. And to your point, they're thinking of all the relevant rules. And then this is definitely an area, not just with the SEC, but I think more broadly, you know, is, I think, will be a continuing area of debate and probably more to come in 2022 on this topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So then to that point, Cherie, very curious. I won't ask you about materiality specifically, but I am interested. You know, we talked here about these climate comment letters, but I know we've also been getting a lot of questions about any human capital specific comment letters. So have you really seen much?
So very different dynamic compared to what we saw in climate. And so maybe that's good news for registrants. And so I think many registrants were concerned that the nature of the comment letters were going to get granular. So, you know, explain to me how you determined something was material. Why didn't you just discuss this? Why didn't you provide any quantitative metrics? The good news is those weren't the nature of the questions. I would say that they were probably pretty basic, right? So for companies that didn't comply with what many would say the bare minimum of disclosing the, you know, demographic information in terms of the number of employees, you know, the nature of your employees being contractors or consultants employed, kind of that type of information, more quantitative around the number of employees. Another point that was raised by Kyle that we saw in the comment letters was this reconciliation to risk factors. So looking at, you know, risk factors, and if you talk about collective bargaining being a risk factor, but then in your human capital disclosure, don't talk about, say, your relationship with, you know, with unions as an example, that was something that was perhaps raised as being a difference. So very kind of, you know, different type, you know, disclosure, comment letters that we were seeing. Now, I do think there's something to perhaps be learned from the comment letters that we're seeing from a climate side, right? Because as Kyle mentioned, this reconciliation from corporate responsibility to what's in the 10K. And so I could imagine in this kind of next round, especially as we've heard Gensler and the SEC staff talk about kind of wanting to get more prescriptive around the disclosures, that they're going to perhaps look at corporate responsibility reports or standalone D&I and human capital reports where companies are disclosing more metrics around, you know, how they manage their human capital and what are some of the material kind of issues that they're dealing with from managing that, and looking at the 10K and saying, well, why isn't this discussed? And so one of my pieces of advice for registrants is to really take a close look at what are you disclosing there and how would you be prepared to respond if the staff came and asked you, why did you disclose it here versus the 10K?
Well, and I guess then, Sheree, to that point, sort of best practices, what do you think registrants should be thinking about as they look ahead, you know, to the upcoming 10K? We talked a little bit about those new factors, but what else should companies be thinking about?
Yeah, I certainly think that, you know, as I mentioned before, companies want to take a measured approach to the disclosures to see what, if any, the SEC was going to say, what do others kind of in their sectors and their actually do, right, compared to what they did. And so I do think that companies should do that evaluation, understand kind of where they stand in the context of their sector and their peers, but also take the learnings from the comment letters around climate, and really think through what are some of the public statements that I've made around human capital. And really challenge yourself to say, well, why did I make those statements? Are they viewed as being material from the perspective of the investor? There's a reason why I said it, right? And so why is that? And then bringing that into the disclosures as appropriate. So I think it is kind of a point in time where you can sit back and reflect on the past year, which saw, you know, human capital and climate and so many other kind of challenges in the SEC being very vocal around what their expectations are, and you know, making sure that you incorporate that while not required, right? But at least incorporate the principles of what you're hearing into the disclosures.
All right. And then maybe, Kyle, I'll turn to you with the same question. From a climate perspective, what would you say companies really should focus in on in light of the rules, what we're seeing from a climate letter perspective, and just as, you know, changing environment?
I mean, I'd say that really revisiting the 2010 interpretive release, I'd say look at the sample Dear Issuer letter that's on the website, but start to really think about, you know, the disclosures in your CSR report versus what's in your 10K or not in your 10K, and be thoughtful about, you know, really whether you do need to disclose something in your 10K. I think the biggest challenge, right, and we haven't spent a lot of time on this, but I know Sheree spends a lot of time talking to clients about this topic, which is just disclosure controls, right? You know, disclosure controls and procedures you have in place to ensure the information is reliable. And to make sure that it's accurate and decision useful. I mean, Gensler has talked about that with respect to climate and human capital of, look, there's, you know, his view is there's a need for prescriptive disclosure requirements. And, you know, the benefits to that are consistent and comparable across companies, across industries.
All right. Well, definitely a lot to think about under the current rules. And I know that's what companies, you know, calendar year end companies will need to focus on for their upcoming year ends. But I think a lot of our listeners have tuned in because they really want to hear what's coming next. So Sheree, I'm going to go back to you first. Yep. Any indications, you know, you gave some hints early on, but any indications what we're going to see and when we may see it on human capital?
So Gensler in some of his speeches over the summer, I think there might have been a few tweets as well that, you know, gave some indication of what they may be looking for, and really, again, driven by what investors have been asking to see. So workforce diversity and demographics, I think, has been top of the list. But things like workforce turnover, and we think about, you know, the conversation we had before, great resignation, employee engagement, that's probably going to be the topic du jour for this, you know, for this upcoming, you know, reporting, right? So just making sure that those concepts are captured. Skills and development training, you know, what things are you doing from a compensation and benefits perspective? I think all of this gets into the workforce turnover and how people are feeling about your organization. So I think those are some of the areas that at least Gensler has indicated. And maybe he was doing in the moment that we were having as well, just because of the, you know, great resignation, some of the, you know, concerns that investors were having around you know, workforce challenges. So I think those are the things that he's kind of specifically you know, talked about. But I think everyone's kind of in this wait and see mode. I feel like it was, you know, a few months over the summer where we thought there was going to be something before Labor Day, but certainly know that they have a lot on their plate. And so I think we're anticipating we're going to see something in early 22, for release.
All right. So, more to come on that. And then Kyle, similarly, I know people are very interested in the new climate rules. And so any sense for when, we've already passed some of the earlier dates you've given me, but I'll let you look at a new crystal ball and then, sense for when, and then as well as what we might be seeing in the release.
Yeah. So I think, you know, from recent commentary, from Gensler, you know, he's looking for by the end of the year, a proposing release. And likely, my guess is it's going to be early next year, as Sheree mentioned, probably January, February timeframe. But as you said, Heather, like, yeah, it's tough to predict. I mean, you know, when you think about all of this going to go into this rulemaking, right? You know, we're thinking about, you know, are they going to codify 2010 guidance, the commission interpretive release? There's a lot of open questions. You know, it's probably early to start talking or thinking about a set of standards or a framework, although Gensler has mentioned, you know, the staff should consider leveraging existing frameworks such as the TCFD framework in this proposal. So I'd expect that may be included in there, or at least questions on the topic. Carbon emissions, right? I think scope one emissions, scope two potentially, even scope three emissions. Those are some of the areas that they're focused on. They're talking a lot about, and question of whether it's in the financial statements, whether it's in the 10K or not in the 10K. Maybe it should be in a specialized disclosure form. And then on top of that, right, is auditor, you know, assurance or attestation, and whether that's something that they want to require. If I had to guess, I think that with Gensler, he's going to put everything on the table as much as he can, and then figure out kind of what will work, potentially scale back if necessary. But again, it's going to be a big challenge, I think. As I think about kind of the challenges that they're going to face, the biggest piece of this is the economic analysis, which, you know, having worked on these rulemakings or similar rulemakings in the past, that's a very challenging area. And essentially that EA is there to justify the cost, the benefits, you know, for each and every rule they propose. They have to use data, which is going to be a challenge for them. How do you pull data to support, you know, the costs and benefits of climate disclosures, an area where we are really just kind of, you know, seeing the tip of the iceberg. And so it's really going to be a challenge to come up with the support they need to support the rules. And then the other piece of it is just having the subject matter experts in the agency to actually write these rules. I imagine they definitely are going to be relying heavily upon the comment period to get, you know, better informed about how they should be thinking about, you know, any new rules that they actually adopt.
All right. And then that's a lot to think about. How about just, I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but do you anticipate any challenges with implementing the rules then?
Yeah, I'd say that well, there'll be challenges implementing the rules, at least from a company's perspective, but from the SEC perspective, I think, you know, they will be challenged, just like resource extraction was and other ones in the past have been. The interesting tidbit of information is resource extraction was something that was in Dodd-Frank, the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, and was initially adopted in 2012 and was then vacated in the courts. And then it went back to the drawing board. And then it's just been through the ringer. and it finally was adopted at the end of 2020. So that's quite a long time. I don't anticipate it'll be a similar lengthy period, but I do think that you know, some states have indicated that they plan to sue. So it's going to be something that the SEC probably is going to have to litigate. Again, though, it's I think Gensler has made clear that he's going to proceed. He's going to move forward, and maybe it takes an act of Congress to push this forward. But I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens. I think anything that's going to happen likely is going to happen when there's final rules that are actually adopted. So we have a bit of time before we see that.
Definitely an interesting topic, more to come. And as always, appreciate all your insights. And thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
That's our show for today. On behalf of the entire podcast team, we wish you a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. We're certainly thankful for all you listeners. And if you need an accounting fix over the long weekend, we have a whole library of past episodes to explore. In fact, we have over 200 episodes at last count, so that should mean a topic for everyone. We'll have a lineup of new shows for you after the Thanksgiving break. Tune in next Tuesday for an episode on SEC comment letter trends in the area of debts, warrants, and equity. And on Thursday, we continue our ESG series with an episode on the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, or TCFD. So that you never miss an episode of any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out to me on LinkedIn with questions, suggestions, or just to connect. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.